KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Welcome to another edition of KSL at Night. I am KSL's legal analyst, Greg Skordas, alongside Taylor Morgan again. Taylor, you and I have been doing a couple shows together lately. What's up with that?
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
I must be doing something right over here at the studio.
I always enjoy being on air with you, Greg. I really like it because we have a nice balance of partisan affiliation or background, I think, but also your legal expertise is, I mean, I can't stop talking to you off air, Greg, because all of my legal questions answered.
And for me, I love talking to you because you know everybody. You know who they're married to, when they went to law school, where they went to school. I should say this, Taylor.
Yeah.
If you ever miss any of our shows, of course, you're usually here, so that's not a problem. You can always go back and listen to it on kslpodcast.com after the show's been aired. I didn't realize that. Just look up KSL at Night.
Excellent.
You can find old editions of the show.
Love it.
Hey, so this is a really troubling story, and I don't know if you've been following this, but the University of Utah women's basketball team is invited to the NCAA tournament, and they played at the host Gonzaga. So they're staying at a local hotel in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. It's about 30 miles to the east, I guess. Northern Idaho. Gonzaga, of course, is Eastern Washington area. And the team's leaving the hotel, they're walking around, going to a place to grab a bite to eat, and some guy pulls up in a pickup truck and yells the N-word. I mean, when was the last time you heard somebody doing something like that? It's just astounding at the students, at the kids.
Yeah.
Of course, there are African-Americans on the team. I think the coach is African-American. And they go to dinner, they come back, and then two cars are there, and they both start shouting racial slurs again at the team. I mean, this is 2024. This is March of 2024,
yeah.
And we're getting this happen to college women who are, you know, this is, can you imagine playing in the NCAA tournament? Can you imagine a greater just excitement? You know what I mean?
It's devastating. It's tragic. It really is so disappointing for these student athletes, for you know, all they have done to get to this place, to get to the NCAA tournament. They're in the semifinals now, I believe, Greg. They have been doing well in the tournament, but yet, personally, outside of the arena, they're having to face what is real, blatant, overt racism. I mean, they're just trying to walk from their hotel in Coeur d'Alene as a team to go get some dinner close by.
Right.
And they're yelled at. And then they're also then followed after dinner.
Right.
And yell that again. And according to head coach Lynn Roberts, they actually had to change their hotel just to make sure that all of the players felt safe. In her post-game press conference addressing what happened, Coach Roberts said, quote, "Racism is real and it happens for our players, whether they are white, black, green, whatever. No one knew how to handle it. It was really upsetting for our players and our staff to not feel safe in an NCAA tournament environment. It's messed up," end quote.
Yeah, how do you handle it? I mean, how do you handle that in this day and age? I mean, when something like that, you just don't expect it. And I imagine those kids were so caught off guard, those players and coaches and staff are walking down, time of their life, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. They're going to play in Gonzaga, beautiful venue. And somebody does something like that, it's got to put a damper on everything you do after that.
Yeah. And we know now that not only the police department there in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, have gotten involved in this, but now, Greg, the FBI is also now involved in investigating this incident, what happened, who was involved with this. We heard here on KSL News Radio that a retired attorney for the FBI, Greg Rogers, stated here on KSL that he has experience with these kinds of things happening in Coeur d'Alene. He spent time working for the FBI in Coeur d'Alene, and he said that, unfortunately, this kind of behavior makes sense for the area, is what he said.
Yeah, and I was wondering about that. And so people have asked me about that, because we do know that there are certain pockets of the country where certain white supremacy groups tend to gather, tend to live. And there are some pockets in northern Idaho, and there are also some incredibly beautiful, wonderful areas up there where these groups congregate. So it maybe isn't as much of a surprise if had it happened in you know, Draper, Utah, or Provo, Utah, or something like that. You wouldn't have expected it. But maybe there's some groups up there. I mean, there are pockets of hate groups that still exist in this country, and they're vocal, and they're going out of their way to make people uncomfortable. And, I mean, you just don't say that. I mean, I don't care. I mean, to me, I'm glad the FBI is involved. I'm glad local law enforcement is taking
a look
at it.
Do you feel like, so as a legal expert, as KSL legal analyst, do you feel like that's an overreaction at all? Do you feel like that is warranted to get the FBI involved? Are we at that level? And again, I'm not justifying or diminishing what happened.
I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah.
Right? Is how can the FBI help? What would their role be?
I would just say this. How could you not get the FBI involved? And I say that because maybe I'm being a little too politically correct. But when something like that happens, there's got to be an investigation. Now, I don't know what the FBI can do. Certainly no one was hurt physically. Yeah. There was no assault. It was a verbal assault. Local law enforcement's looking into it. The FBI, I'm sure, is going to look into it. But you're right. I mean, is that overkill in a case like this? I just think you can't leave this one alone in any respect. There's no law enforcement agency that's going to say, hey, nobody was hurt, no harm, no foul, go play your basketball game. That's not going to happen in 2024.
That's a good point. Just because racism exists and racism happens doesn't mean that it's not a serious thing, right? And it should not be treated as if it's commonplace. I will give some credit. I want to commend Idaho Governor Brad Little for taking to X, formerly Twitter, issuing a very strong statement, thanking the Coeur d'Alene community for stepping up to reinforce, make sure that the city is a safe place to be. He unequivocally condemned what happened and what was said, has committed to working with law enforcement. So it's not certainly not all of the community. It's not all of Idaho. There are bad actors in every community.
Right.
Of course, we saw Governor Spencer Cox here in Utah commended Idaho Governor Little on his statement. So I think it is important and great that everyone is taking this very, very seriously. And if you ever want to hold an NCAA event in your city ever again, you better do that.
Oh, yeah. Good point. Good point. So if you're going to be, if you're Gonzaga and you want to have the NC2A there, because that's a big deal.
I mean, you
drive by the Delta Center this last weekend and it was packed. There are people there trying to buy tickets for any price they can.
And it's not just the racism. Greg, it is also the threatening behavior following the team after dinner to the hotel. And also the fact that these are women. These are female student athletes. I think that there is some additional concern there given who was following them and what was happening there with the threatening behavior. So really quick, we have just a few seconds left, Greg. As a legal analyst, a legal expert, if the Coeur d'Alene Police Department and the FBI do track down who's responsible, what could they be charged with?
You know, I was thinking about that, and that's a great question. Is it something like disorderly conduct, disturbing the peace? And if Idaho has, and I believe they do, hate crime statutes as we do here in Utah, there are crimes that really track each other very closely. You can enhance a crime. You can say, well, normally disorderly conduct or that type of thing is a mid-level misdemeanor. But if it's a hate crime, and it clearly is, I don't know how you could define a hate crime anymore.
Hateful words do qualify as a hate crime.
Right. Okay. Especially if they're directed at a certain group, especially if they're using derogatory words like that. Yes, it could be a hate crime. And that's why local law enforcement and the FBI is looking at it. What surprises me is in this day and age when we have so many video cameras on intersections and cell phones and things like that, that nobody has been wrapped up yet. You would think that there would be something going on. They must have a suspect going somewhere.
Yeah.
Well, when we come back after the break, we're going to talk to Utah Representative Phil Lyman, who you know really well, about something really interesting that happened in Baltimore this week involving a bridge collapse. Stay with us.
KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. This is Taylor Morgan here with Greg Skordis. Greg, on Tuesday, as we all know, there was a tragic incident in Baltimore. The Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed early Tuesday after it was struck by a very large container ship that had lost power. We know that as of today, Wednesday, March 27th, we're recording this a little bit earlier in the afternoon, Greg. So this could change by the time the show airs this evening. But as of right now, we know that six individuals are still missing. Recovery efforts are underway there in Baltimore. Certainly a tragedy. Watching the footage of the bridge collapse online.
Oh, yeah.
Just unbelievable. I've never seen anything quite like that, Greg.
And I didn't realize this until we had a guest on last night, Taylor, but this bridge actually is a huge artery between two areas across this river. And apparently, with the bridge being gone, it will take an additional hour for some people to get to these two various venues. And it's highly used by, and apparently
it's not like traffic in Baltimore,
right,
isn't already terrible.
Right. So, I mean, what a mess. And, you know, the captain of the ship had the wherewithal to say, Mayday, called a Mayday out. The police did everything they could to evacuate the bridge. And it's 1:30 in the morning. I mean, it's not rush hour, which would have been devastating. But, I mean, any death is obviously devastating. But the authorities there were able to minimize the loss as much as possible. But boy, when that ship hit the post that's holding the bridge up, apparently the bridge has an area that you can clear. A large ship can go underneath it. But you've got to have your power. You've got to be able to navigate through that area. When you lose power, you start going sideways and you hit one of the piers that's holding the bridge up. Boy, you're in deep trouble.
Yeah, certainly tragic. Obviously, we wish the best for the families and loved ones of all the victims. Now, Greg, this accident and those essentially responsible, those employed at the Port of Baltimore, those involved with, Baltimore Public Service, all of this has kicked off a little bit of a political conversation, Greg, about the response, about the qualifications of public employees involved at the Port of Baltimore.
Which is perfectly understandable. You've got to look at this and say, what happened and why?
I think that's fair. I think that, listen, sometimes policy isn't always the answer. Sometimes we can overanalyze and overrespond with public policies. At the same time, we should be looking closely at accidents and everything and seeing if there are things that we can do to mitigate, to minimize and prevent. Where we want to go now is we want to have a conversation with Utah's own Utah Representative Phil Lyman, who is from Blanding, Utah, southeastern Utah, just incredible part of the state. Phil Lyman is a Republican who is currently serving in the Utah House of Representatives. He is also currently challenging Governor Spencer Cox for the Republican nomination for governor. Representative Lyman addressed the incident in Baltimore on X, formerly Twitter, with some, I don't know how to, I don't want to categorize these, but these were interesting, controversial, perhaps, takes on what happened in Baltimore and why, connecting it to DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. We know, Greg, that DEI has been a hot topic in Utah. The sure. Utah legislature
was one of the hot topics the first week of the legislature.
Governor Spencer Cox, even, right. And the Utah legislature just passed landmark legislation in Utah doing away with DEI requirements at public institutions. So with that setup and with that background, we want to welcome Representative Phil Lyman to the show. Phil, thank you for joining us. You have definitely got a lot of attention on X with your comments, some positive, some critical, of course. But really, we want to get to the underlying issue at hand, and that is DEI and the qualifications of the public employees at the Port of Baltimore. Can you start us off there?
Right. First of all, thanks for having me come on and talk about this. There's a lot of criticism, and X is a wild, it's the Wild West out there. the post that was made, I take responsibility for my account, the Phil Lyman for Governor account, but I do have people that post. When I saw that post go up, that was the first thing I asked was, what's the background on this? It happens that I've got a person on my staff who's from Baltimore, and he said, and that was kind of his take right off the bat. So the post, was making a correlation that, are we prioritizing the well-being and security of citizens, or do we prioritize diversity? And that's basically what the post said, drawing a correlation, not a causation, but a correlation between the two, and also playing off some of the other posts that were out there. We shared a post that was pointing out something similar to that, that the that this was a DEI. Several key people in this were, you know, their hiring was influenced by DEI.
The post you're referring to was posted by the Young Conservative Federation. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
Great.
Yeah.
No, that's very helpful clarification and background. Appreciate that.
So talk to us, Representative, about the, not the causation, but you used the word correlation. And I do understand what's being said here, but explain that thought. What the thought was about this DEI as it has any relation to something so catastrophic as this.
And it's good to speak with you, Greg. It's good to hear your voice on the show. So thanks for the question. I guess the correlation is simply that they have a robust DEI program going that oversees the port, oversees the bridge, and they had a catastrophe that was either intentional or unintentional, and getting all the information that's still coming in, as you say. The question really, it is a DEI slam of saying, from my campaign standpoint, we're not proponents of DEI. We're not proponents of hiring people based on DEI or implementing DEI in Utah, at our universities, in our schools. And when those types of things influence policy, often the outcomes are not what we would have hoped. And this is a bad outcome. DEI was a high priority for this county and for the port. And that's the only correlation. So saying, well, they do have this, they had this tragedy, they had this huge mishap, and they had DEI that's firmly in place in their, in their port management.
I think it's really interesting because according to social media posts and according to the Young Conservative Federation and information that they have provided to document this, just a week before this accident happened, the Port of Baltimore published a video for Women's History Month celebrating women breaking into the male-dominated field of piloting. And, of course, if you have a qualified female, they should absolutely break into the male-dominated field. And that is absolutely something to celebrate. But we shouldn't be posting those things and putting people in positions they're not qualified for, regardless of their background, their ethnicity, their religion, their gender, their sexual orientation, regardless of those things. I think perhaps if I can presume, Representative, you're talking about merit and being qualified for the position, not necessarily having the position to check the box of DEI optics. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And I see this a lot, Greg. You can feel free to disagree with me, Greg. We need to disagree more on air, I think, Greg Skordis. We probably should argue more. But I see this a lot with nonprofit organizations, particularly here in Utah in the outdoor and the environmental space.
Sure.
I see a lot of nonprofit organizations that care a lot more about these kind of
optics
among their staff and their teams and their boards, what their favorite outdoor hobby or activity is, rather than what their qualifications are for being involved leading a nonprofit. So it's not something that just happens in Baltimore. I think that this is a political thing that can happen anywhere.
And Representative Lyman, actually, we're out of time. I'm just getting waved off. Phil, if I could call you that, thank you so much for joining us.
Please.
I really appreciate your time today, your honesty and your integrity and just filling in the blanks for us.
Yeah, I really appreciate all that background and look forward to having you back soon, Representative.
Thank you so much. I'm really appreciative of the invitation. So thanks to both of you.
Yeah, great conversation, Greg. We ran out of time and I don't think we even got started.
I wanted to ask him some more questions.
I know. Certainly something we can talk a lot more about. Coming up next, we are going to talk all about how to avoid election scams.
KSL at night.
And you're with us again on KSL at night alongside Taylor Morgan. I'm your host, Greg Skordis. And this is something I don't really think about much, Taylor, but election season coming up and scammers wanting to take your money. And I'm thinking that never happens. But guess what? Since this show started, I get a text from somebody who wants me to donate money to preserve ranked choice voting. Now, I don't know if it's a scam or not. Hmm. I don't even know enough about ranked choice voting.
Was there a disclaimer or a link or a paid for by on the text, Greg?
Yes.
Okay.
So, I mean, and it also has an opt out. stop.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Stop, and you can up. But I'll bet I get those every day. And I hadn't thought about it, but apparently scammers are really up in the ante right now, especially with the political climate that we have. And a lot of people saying, hey, I want to I got to do something about what's going on. I'm going to make a contribution.
Well, Donald Trump has texted me 36 times today, Greg, and Laura Trump, co-chair of the RNC, has also personally texted me 6 times during the show, all asking for money. Of course, I think I say that because, as you pointed out, it is very difficult this time of year with candidates and campaigns and political action committees, all kinds of organizations and people trying to communicate with donors, with voters. There are legitimate campaign communications that have the appropriate disclosures, the 10DLC registration. We can perhaps get into that.
But then,
because of all these political communications and text messages that may technically be legitimate, this really creates a field of opportunity for scammers.
Well, let's give some help to our listeners from somebody who knows and who can help us understand scammers. And we're talking to Tim Johnston, Vice President of Outreach at the Better Business Bureau. Tim, thank you so much for joining us this evening on KSL at Night.
Hey, glad to be with you.
So tell us, are we up in the night here, or what is going on, and what can our listeners be looking at as they consider some of these prompts that they're getting on their internet, or some of these texts that they're getting on their phone?
I was going to say, you talked about the number of texts that you've received so far during the program, and I talked to an individual yesterday, and they probably received just the same amount, and it was not even noon that day. But I think when you boil it down, scammers are opportunists. They take advantage of the situation, and the election season is upon us. I mean, it's happening earlier than we probably expected, and that means we'll be receiving lots of texts, calls, emails, and letters, and so scammers are going to find a way to take advantage of that. And if you know that scammers are really after one of two things from you, and if they really, when they get both, they're looking for your personal information or your financial information, and it's really easy to contact people via text. And so they're going to send out text messages hoping that you will click because you're driven by a particular issue or maybe a particular candidate, and draw you to a site that may look similar to another legitimate website, asking you to put in your personal information and also financial information to give to a candidate or a cause. So it's just one of those things. We want to make sure that it's a good reminder that if you get a text and you're not expecting it, don't respond. Don't click on unknown links. And if it is a cause or a candidate that you want to, that you're interested in giving to, then reach out directly to those causes and candidates after you've had a chance to do your due diligence.
We're speaking with Tim Johnston, Vice President of Outreach at the Better Business Bureau, about election season being prime time for scammers. Tim, what are some of the tips or tricks or the ways that we can tell a scam apart from a actual campaign or legitimate communication?
So when it comes to text, and you know, I would say that that's probably what is the major pain point for individuals, or they're getting a lot of them. It can be very difficult to break it down and know what's legitimate and what's not. I just did a presentation earlier today and showed two texts. One was from a place that I bought some clothes online, and then another text was a scam, telling me that there was an issue with the delivery, and both were related to deliveries. And if you don't know what to look for, you could click on the one that's telling you that there's an issue, and in that type of scam, you know, probably all seen it during the holidays, is they're looking for your personal information and also a credit card to be able to pay a small fee for them to make that change. So I would say when it comes to text messages, whether it's for a particular candidate or a particular cause, as we would suggest with anything, if it is an unsolicited text, don't click on that link. Don't call that phone number. And if it's raised your interest in supporting that cause or that candidate, why, reach out directly through a source that you know is legitimate by looking up that candidate's webpage or look more into that particular cause and reach out to that organization directly.
Tim, it seems to me that the more and more use that we have of our phones, our cell phones, of our laptops, our computers, has really increased the number of scammers that are out there approaching people. I mean, I know we're talking about election scam, but I sell and buy things on KSL.com all the time. And invariably, and I think KSL's done a great job, but invariably somebody will reach out to you as soon as you post something, and you can almost tell that it's a scam, but it just seems like it's almost rampant these days, Tim, with the use of the internet.
Well, technology has really made it easy for individuals to communicate just down the street and across the world. And so gone are the days of bad faxes being passed right to your business, saying that they have some money from a Nigerian prince. I mean, those things still come through, but not at the numbers that scammers take advantage of technology like texting or creating fake websites. And even during an election season, we'll still see mailings that come through, but those are not inexpensive for a campaign or a cause. And so a scammer is going to look for a way to be able to reach the masses at a very inexpensive rate, hoping that somebody will click on that link, call that number, or visit a website that will gather information. And I think that's something to be thinking about during this time is, think about what you would normally be asked by, let's say, a pollster. You know, they'll ask you for some demographic information, what party you most align with, what issues are your pain points, or what, you think a candidate should focus in on.
Yeah.
But if they're asking you for personal information, like your birth date, social security number, financial information, shut that down immediately, disconnect.
Definitely.
Hang up the phone or get off that website. And something else we want to remind people is if you do find yourself in that situation, do report it. It's important for organizations like the Better Business Bureau and also law enforcement to know what is taking place out in the community. If no reports come in, nobody knows, what's going on. So we encourage people to report.
Great point. Yeah.
Scam tracker is one way to do that, whether you've lost money or not. And that's available at bbb.org/scam tracker.
You just read my mind, Tim, because I was going to say, who do you report to? So say that one more time.
So encourage people to report to BBB Scam Tracker on our website at bbb.org/scam tracker. And if you have given your financial information or money, and you think it was a fraud or a scam, reach out to local law enforcement. The faster you do that, the better. It's not a guarantee that you'll get your money back, but if you wait too long, the chances greatly diminish.
Tim Johnston, VP of Outreach at the Better Business Bureau, thank you for joining us this evening on KSL at Night. Hope we have you back.
Thanks, Tim.
Well, thank you.
When we come back after the break, we're going to talk about a really unusual new criminal case that was filed in Salt Lake County involving hit and run. You won't believe what happened in this case, Taylor. Stay with us.
KSL at Night. KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. You are with Taylor Morgan and Greg Skordis. Greg, great show so far. A lot of very interesting conversations and topics. This latest story coming out about a Utah driver targeting and hitting multiple female pedestrians is, I'm not going to say fascinating. It is certainly troubling, developing story still. It's certainly something that I am very interested in learning more about and in following. And despite my better judgment now, Greg Skordis, we are going to bring on another Democratic attorney to the program here on KSL at Night to help us understand what's happening. And of course, that is Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill. Sim, welcome to the show. Tell us about this case. What is happening with this driver targeting and hitting multiple pedestrians?
Well, thank you for the kind invitation. And this is one of those cases that you typically would not think about because, you know, we have so many accidents that happen. So the frequency and the prevalence of accidents and people hit and drive away, and they're often left unresolved. And under that prevalence, there was, a, you know, under that sort of shroud of, you know, a conduct, we had these multiple accidents that were going on. And luckily, as we started to look into it, there was a sort of a common theme that started to develop. And by putting those together from an incident that happened in August of 2023 to three separate incidents that we outlined in our probable cause statement that happened in February and March of 2024, and some good police work, we were able to identify that there was a single person who was involved in this. And then as they went back and started to work that through the investigative process, identifying witnesses and victims and evidence that we looked at, that this was not just some random accident that was happening, but rather more intentional and predatory. And that was what was really alarming about all of this.
Yeah, when I first heard, Sim, about the charges of hit and run, I'm thinking somebody's bashing their car into other cars. But these are pedestrians and female pedestrians. Sim, were any, I mean, I can't imagine anyone was not hurt seriously, but were some of these injuries quite serious?
Yeah, you know, first of all, thank God that nobody has succumbed to them. But having said that, beyond just the trauma of getting hit and the fear and the violence that perpetrates on an individual in physical and emotional harm, we've had several of our victims who really were seriously injured, including a couple of them that have been suffered from brain bleeds, subdural hematomas, as well as had to be intubated. So these are very, very and are very, very serious injuries that were suffered by many of these victims.
Can you tell us, Sim, how law enforcement put this together? Because I'm looking at the charging document. They were separate dates, separate locations, not even the same jurisdiction. I mean, they're all within Salt Lake County, at least the six that I'm looking at. But we're talking about Sandy City, Salt Lake City. I mean, this had to be a pretty concerted effort on law enforcement to put all of this together to find out this individual that's causing all this mess.
Yeah, you're right, Greg. And you know that because we have so many different law enforcement agencies here, often these accidents are sort of left as unresolved as accidents in law enforcement. One of the things that we're trying to direct all of our local jurisdictions to think about is in the last 6 to 12 months, if they have unresolved hit and runs, to go back and maybe take a look at some of those, because our fear is that there may be some other folks there. Mm. There were some other things that we were working on that did not rise to the putting it together for the purposes of this information, but we are continuing to look at it. And so to answer your first question there, it was going back and starting to look at some common themes. You know, what you had was that you had a vehicle that was coming, and some of the witnesses talked about that the vehicle looked like it had come back multiple passes at some of the victims before they were hit.
Oh, my word.
Then we, yeah. So in one or two scenarios where you actually have this vehicle driving by the victims, going down, turning around and coming back and driving by again in this sort of predatory sort of way, if you will, yeah, almost in a stalking sort of way, and waiting for them to get into the crosswalk and, you know, slowing down and waiting for people to get into the crosswalk before actually speeding up against the light and hitting these folks in the crosswalk, right?
Yeah.
And so you started to get these common themes. You started to get a common description. And then it was just going back and doing some good old-fashioned police work of looking at some of the LPRs, looking at some of the witnesses, going back and mining for video evidences and putting those together. There was an accident that happened that had left some debris behind that connected back into the vehicle, and then tying this vehicle back through some intelligence and hard work into locations and times back into where these accidents happened. Hmm. So it took a little bit of effort and putting together this puzzle to get to the point of charging.
We're speaking with Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill about the ongoing investigation around alleged crimes involving repeat hit and run offenses. It appears as if there is some coordination, motivation, certainly a repeat offender. Prosecutors have identified the suspect as On Dewey Pham. Am I getting that pronunciation right there, Sim? Please correct me if I'm not.
No, that's correct. And it's also important to know these are allegations.
Yes, so there's allegations. The suspect at this time, these are allegations. The suspect's age is 26. Prosecutors have said that he is homeless and was living out of his car. Sim, do we have any sense of his intent here? What was his motivation? What would prompt him to commit multiple hit and runs, but to do it in such a targeted way, specifically trailing victims
and all female pedestrians.
All of these are alleged crimes, right? The investigation is underway, to be clear again about that. But do we have any sense of what the intent or motivation was here?
You know, I think those are the things that we're still working through. But from an objective evidentiary perspective, you know, we've been able to put this together. Clearly, the identified victims in our charges are primarily females, mother, daughter, friends walking, friends going out on walks in pairs. And even in one incident, what seemed like an attempt to abduct and bring this woman into the vehicle when she resisted and ran away, that she was mowed down, driven and struck. So, you know, we're still trying to piece that together. And as you know, Greg, that sometimes you'll never be able to piece that together. The question is whether we have compelling, admissible evidence to warrant the filing of charges and then carry our burden of proof. And we feel like we do. And so we filed the charges we did.
And I'm looking at the charges, Sim, and I think you answered this a little bit, but it's not reckless driving or assault. These are six counts of attempted murder. These are first-degree felonies. Mm. So your law enforcement and your investigators must have felt, like you described, Sim, that these were targeted attacks on these pedestrians with the intent to do much more than just scare somebody. I mean, these cause serious injury, and you've alleged attempted murder.
You're absolutely correct. You know, this is not an allegation of reckless, accidental, not paying attention kind of behavior. As we kind of outline in our probable cause statement, you know, we have evidence where he's actually slowing down his speed and going into the bike lane and then intentionally speeding up. In one of the incidents, we can actually have evidence both from witnesses and other evidence that we gathered that he actually comes up and drives and slows down to almost a crawl to the point where the witnesses thought that was really sort of odd and creepy behavior.
Yes. Yeah.
Until the light has come and the two females are walking through the crosswalk. And then he intentionally speeds and targets them and hits them, you know?
Just terrible.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Sim, thank you so much. We unfortunately are out of time. We'll wrap it there. Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill, thanks again for joining us here on KSL at Night. Greg, coming up next, we are going to talk all about former RNC chair Mitt Romney's niece, BYU grad Ronna McDaniel, your favorite former RNC chairwoman, Greg. Well, her new stint at NBC
lasted
less than a week, Greg. Yeah. We're going to get into that story after the break.
KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Welcome back to the second hour of KSL at Night. I'm your host, Greg Skordis, alongside Taylor Morgan. And remember, if you missed any of our shows, you can always go back and listen to it on kslpodcast.com after the show's been aired. Just look up KSL at Night. And if Taylor was on the show, you definitely want to make sure you picked it up.
I don't know about that. Perhaps, Mom, if you're listening, that's that one's for you.
There you go. So you're going to have to help me with this one. But Ronna McDaniel, former Republican National Committee chairwoman, gets a job with NBC News to be a political host. The job lasts about a week.
Yeah.
A couple of days, and she's let go over protests over concern about hiring her as a paid contributor. Now, I don't know if this is sort of the media trying to be a little politically correct. She's a fairly far right consultant, very pro Trump, conservative commentator, popular, well known, well liked by a lot of people. But I guess NBC News just decided it was too dangerous.
They were outraged, Greg. Yeah. There was a lot of folks on high horses in the NBC newsroom there among other hosts and correspondents and contributors. They were not happy with the corporations with NBC's decision to bring Ronna McDaniel on as a political contributor, former RNC chairwoman. Ronna McDaniel, Greg, she just cannot get a break not to defend everything she has said or done, because she does have a little bit of a problematic history, Greg, that we'll get into here in a moment. Ronna McDaniel is a graduate of Brigham Young University, a niece of Utah Senator Mitt Romney. Ronna McDaniel really rose to fame, or at least power, within the Trump team and national Republican politics back when she played a key role in helping flip Michigan from blue to red for Donald Trump, and rose to power, became chairwoman of the Republican National Party. The irony of this, Greg, is presumably NBC fired her or cut her contract after hiring her because there were folks at NBC that were outraged that Ronna McDaniel was a contributor, because Ronna McDaniel would be too pro-Trump, would be biased. Ronna McDaniel lost her spot as RNC chairwoman because she refused to pick sides with Donald Trump during the Republican primary, during the Republican nomination process. As RNC chair, she insisted on staying neutral and not going all in behind Trump. And that is why Trump essentially forced her out and replaced her with his own hand-picked successors.
Trump forced a lot of people out of the RNC recently. I think something like 20% of their staff was moved out, not necessarily. I mean, you can't blame Trump directly, but indirectly, it seems like he was coming in saying, look, I'm the candidate now. I need the RNC behind me 100%, and I need my people with the RNC behind me 100%.
Well, and I'm sure, again, I can't speak for Ronna McDaniel and say with certainty what she would have done, but it is entirely expected that during a party nomination process or a party primary, the actual party itself and its elected officers would stay neutral.
Right.
I have never not seen party elected officials, at least publicly, not be neutral, because that's just what you do. It's the right thing to do when your party is trying to choose who is going to represent the party. You should not be handpicking who that person is. You should let your party members do that.
You have to assume, Taylor, that this wasn't necessarily a financial decision, because she, controversial or not, is going to bring viewers to NBC News.
Absolutely.
I mean, you would think that I'm sure that's why they hired her in the first place.
Yeah.
This is a public figure. She's well known. She's well known by a lot of people, whether you like her or not. She's there, and people are going to tune in to see what she has to say during the election process over the next, 5 or 6 months?
Yeah.
And get her take on things.
Yeah.
So, I mean—
Let's be real. There is not one single political reporter, political commentator, contributor, political pundit that doesn't have a bias.
Sure.
It's politics. And the fact that you have people that are insiders, Greg— that do have a bias, and I'll admit it. Listen, I am involved in politics. I'm a Republican political consultant here in Utah. I have a bias. I have conflicts, but I disclose those. I'm clear about those. But what I think perhaps gives me value in listening to is that I have an insider perspective, right? Well, all this blew up, Greg. This uproar came from NBC and MSNBC journalists and anchors on live TV after an internal announcement from the network on Friday. This just happened last Friday. They announced internally that they were going to hire Ronna McDaniel to provide, quote, an insider's perspective on national politics and the future of the Republican Party.
Yeah, and we're hearing also that McDaniel is considering legal options after her deal was canceled.
Yeah.
Less than a week after it was announced, she's no longer being represented by her agent, but she's looking for an attorney to negotiate with NBC on her behalf. I don't know what the damages are when you haven't really started your job yet. But if she gave up other opportunities, if she had other things she could have done, and she, let's say she moved or she took up residence, she rented an apartment, she did this or that, she may have some damages. And NBC can't be coming out of this very good, but maybe they thought that it was the lesser of the two evils.
Yeah.
Here's the thing.
Right,
go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Here's the thing. There are claims. Those claims have not yet been proven out. That Rhonda McDaniel was involved somehow in the conspiracy around the fake elector strategy for Donald Trump. There's no evidence of that. She has not been charged with a crime, Greg.
Right.
But yet that is the point of outrage, of contention among other hosts at NBC and MSNBC. So really alarming is, and this is how I see it, this is my opinion, I think it is alarming when a news organization, when the chairman, Cesar Conde, chairman of NBC Universal News Group, states, quote, "No organization, particularly a newsroom, can succeed unless it is cohesive and aligned. Over the last few days, it has become clear that this appointment undermines that goal." So, Greg, are we just talking about not being able to bring in a contrasting voice that disagrees
with
our
worldview?
Because
the other members of the staff are going, "Hey, wait a minute, we're not being cohesive. We're not aligned with this."
So when you say you want to be cohesive and aligned, does that mean you all have to have the same political bias in your reporting? I mean, that is a huge problem if you're talking about the press and the media.
Right.
And there's all this rhetoric nationally. And we know that Donald Trump really leaned into this. And he will again in claiming that the media is biased. It's fake news. It's just the liberal press. I think NBC just confirmed it.
Yeah. And I can't imagine this is going to be good for NBC. I mean, you and I are somewhat examples of the fact that, you know, we can get along. We come from different backgrounds. We come from different political persuasions and whatnot. But, you know, we're just reporting on the news. We're interviewing guests. We're trying to educate the public. And I don't know that she comes into as a correspondent, as a media person with a perceived bias. Whether that just means, well, she just can't do it. Give her a chance. Give her a couple months.
You need to have another voice, a different voice. And having an insider, again, I'm not saying that Rhonda McDaniel is, you know, a perfect person that doesn't have a sketchy history in some ways, right? However, having her experience and her inside voice as a commenter on the upcoming election, that would be invaluable, Greg. And I'll tell you what, I would have watched NBC, but I'm not going to now.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be hard to say, wait a minute, you know, we'll forgive and forget. I mean, give her a chance. I don't know. I don't know her as well as you do. I don't know her background as well as you do. You seem to have a pretty good understanding of it. I didn't realize she was Mitt Romney's niece, you say?
She is. Yeah. Brigham Young University graduate and niece of Utah Senator Mitt Romney.
Well, that was enough right there to put her on the news.
There you go.
When we come back after the break, we're going to talk about the new RNC chair, speaking of which. And
are you talking about Donald Trump's daughter-in-law?
Yeah, Laura Trump, talking about the 2020 election and the 2024 election. Stay with us.
KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. This is Taylor Morgan alongside KSL legal analyst expert Greg Skordas. Greg, we've had a great show so far. We've been talking everything national politics, local stories, a few fun things here in between. We have to talk about the NBC interview with RNC co-chair Laura Trump. This is fascinating stuff. We know that Rhonda McDaniel was essentially forced out as RNC chairwoman.
Yep.
Presumably, the claim is there that because she was neutral in the Republican presidential nomination process, that she did not get on Team Trump too early enough. Trump was not happy about that and other things, and essentially pushed her out and handpicked her successors.
And Laura Trump is the former president's daughter-in-law.
That is correct. And in this latest interview, new RNC co-chair Laura Trump broke with former President Donald Trump on the conversation surrounding the 2020 election and early voting. Very interesting interview, real political implications here. And we wanted to bring on the show to help us understand exactly what was said and the fallout. One of our favorite commentators, correspondents from ABC News, Andy Field. Andy, welcome to KSL at Night. Tell us about this interview and what was said.
A lot was said, and I'm trying to remember. There was a Jim Carrey movie where he kept saying two different things. I think it was Liar, Liar. not to say that she's a liar, but that he would say one thing and then he would slap his face and he would tell the truth out of the other side of
his face. I think that movie was about attorneys, right, Greg?
Yeah, sorry about that. But yeah. Thanks, Andy. Thanks for bringing
that
up.
Well, anyway, it was just bizarre. You saw him wrestling with himself, trying to say one thing while trying to hide the other. Well, it's interesting that Laura Trump is now pretty much going back on almost everything she said during the last election, and even going back on things that Donald Trump has said. For example, they say we're past litigating the 2020 election here. I think that's the past. That's in the past. But she hasn't gotten the memo from her father-in-law, Donald Trump, that it's very much in the present, because every time he has a chance to say it, whether it's in an interview or in a rally, he keeps saying the 2020 election was rigged, that there was problems with the mail-in voting, that they were harvesting votes, that early voting was bad. And now Laura Trump is saying a lot of that stuff now is good. That during the primaries, she said Republicans made it clear that they like early voting, that they like mail-in voting, and that the RNC has made or managed to push all these changes that has suddenly made all these things that really were not a problem much better.
Andy, go ahead.
Your head's going to spin a little bit when you listen to this interview.
Yeah. You know, we interviewed earlier, we talked earlier about former RNC chair Ronna McDaniel and her brief stint at NBC News. I don't know if you're aware of that, but she was in, she was out. But a lot of the RNC staff was jettisoned in favor of the presumptive presidential nominee from the Republican Party. And Laura Trump wasn't just selected there randomly. I mean, Donald Trump seems to be putting his people in place. Is Laura Trump really a good fit for him? Is that the message he wants to send, is what Laura Trump is trying to sell?
I don't know. I know she was his pick. That's all I can tell you. But look, Donald Trump very often has officials that he's handpicked that he will publicly contradict. You know, there were other issues in this here. It wasn't just the mail-in voting and the rigged election and stuff. She talked about abortion. Oh, well, before we get to abortion, he said, talked about the fact that the RNC now has a joint fundraising operation with the Trump campaign, and a lot of money, if you're a Republican National Committee donor, unless you tell them otherwise, some of that money is going to go into Donald Trump's lawyers' pockets, because it will be funneled to one of his political action committees, which is paying most of it, if not all, of his legal bills. There are Republicans who aren't happy about that.
Certainly a difficult position for the co-chairs of the RNC to be in, because, of course, they, to some degree, they need to keep national donors and mega donors happy with the RNC. And there are other campaigns and strategies that cost money outside of just the Trump campaign. And do you think that Laura Trump here is trying to speak to those Republican donors and perhaps reassure them that there's competent leadership at the RNC?
Well, this is her quote. She goes, "I think the reason that I'm here is to assure people who've had any question as to how their money's being spent." Although she was quoted before she became chairman as saying every dime will be spent on electing Donald Trump. Now she's saying, can they trust the RNC? Can they donate to this entity? And she says, trust me, I'm the daughter-in-law of Donald Trump. I will ensure every penny of every dollar is going to causes that Republican voters care about. Now, I know a lot of Republican voters care about a lot of things, and it's not all Donald Trump. So that kind of contradicts what she said before she became chairman, which is that every resource will be devoted toward getting Donald Trump reelected.
How is this not a conflict? to have his daughter-in-law as co-chair of the RNC, to have this money being commingled, how are Republicans responding to these handpicked co-chairs at the RNC, Andy?
Well, the Republicans have a steering committee that vote to put these people on the board, and for whatever reason, they thought it was okay, and that's the Republican National Committee now. Usually presidents can mold the Republican or Democratic National Committee in the shape that they want with the people that they want. It's just never seemed as blatant as this, in that it's, or at least it appears on the surface, or the way Donald Trump would like it, is that all efforts will be going toward him, whereas there's a whole lot of other Republicans that need the Republican National Committee help, and Laura Trump is trying to reassure them to say, oh, no, 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 if you don't want to have your money going into the or have any chance of going into the funds that pay for Donald Trump's lawyers, you can check a box, I guess, and opt out of that.
Yeah. You know, other than to get his daughter-in-law in the position, what do you suppose the concern was with Ronna McDaniel as it relates to the Trump campaign, Andy? I mean, she's a fairly right-speaking, thinking, acting individual. You would think that she would be right on board, right in line with the Trump organization and their message, but they oust her from the RNC.
I don't know the answer other than you need complete and utter fealty to Donald Trump in order to have any of these positions.
Yeah.
She said she had to remain neutral during the primaries, which may have angered Donald Trump and may be one of the reasons that he told her to go find other work.
Yeah. Has Ronna McDaniel sent you her resume yet, Andy? So just curious.
I'm looking through the pile of resumes. I haven't seen it yet, but look, it's a head scratcher why this happened in the first place.
Yeah.
And you know, people have compared this to Jen Psaki and even our George Stephanopoulos at ABC and such, saying, well, these are all former political operatives. Why did these news organizations hire them? And I think, at least from the backlash that they got at NBC and from outside, was that none of these people, Psaki, Stephanopoulos, or others, had so consistently and demonstrably not told the truth on so many different occasions.
Yeah.
None of those people supported overturning an election or election denial or false claims about election interference.
Yeah.
That have been dispelled by more than 60 courts at this point. So
yeah.
There is a difference in the person, not necessarily in the job that they came from.
Definitely. And we should point out that alongside Laura Trump at the RNC as co-chair, Michael Whatley, a North Carolina Republican who has been very known for echoing Trump's false claims of voter fraud. So an interesting dynamic at the RNC. We will see how this plays out. Andy Field, ABC News, thank you so much for joining KSL at Night. Looking forward to having you back soon as we track this story and others.
All right, guys. Thanks.
Coming up next here on KSL at Night, Greg,
your favorite new word.
We are going to get into extraterritoriality. If you don't know what that means, you'll want to stay with us after the break.
KSL at Night.
You're back with us on KSL at Night. I am Greg Skordis, and I am alongside Taylor Morgan. Taylor, question. What jurisdiction do states have with respect to other states? What authority do they have to go into other states and impose their will, if at all?
It's a great question, Greg.
You should be asking me that, I guess.
You are the KSL legal analyst, so I hope you have an answer for your own question there. I do think that the question is very interesting, legally, politically, of course, with what has been happening recently in the United States, specific to, I'm thinking of Texas and immigration law.
And Texas and abortion
law.
Right.
Some certainly very top controversial issues and political questions that will play a very important role front and center in the upcoming 2024 presidential election. Texas has really been flexing their muscles as a state, Greg. I mean, Texas has always been known for doing that, I think, in some ways, but they're doing it now in new. I don't know. I don't want to get too far down the road of commending what they're doing, but specific to immigration law,
right?
Immigration law has been a total at a total political stalemate in Congress for 40 years. And what Texas is doing might shake up the status quo and just might force change. So in that way, it could be good, but I really don't know. And I'm looking to you as the attorney in the room to tell me how I'm wrong.
Yeah. And oh, no, you're not. And I was surprised a little bit. I think a lot of people were when the Supreme Court jumped in and said, we are not going to stop the Texas law going into effect, which allows Texas authorities to do what has historically for hundreds of years been the province of the federal government, and that is to control the borders. Texas said, look, Biden administration, you were in charge of controlling the borders. You haven't done a good job. We're going to do it for you. We're going to impose our will on what has historically been federal jurisdiction, federal law, and say, we're going to have agents come in here and we're going to. And what they're doing is they're sort of tweaking it and saying, well, it's public safety. We have the right to enforce laws within our state. Of course, the state has a right to do that.
Yeah.
So Texas is saying that. The Fifth Circuit hasn't necessarily agreed. We don't know. The law was supposed to be put on hold. The Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to put it on hold. Go litigate your case. In the meantime, that's the law of the land in Texas.
Yeah. And we know that Utah Governor Spencer Cox has visited the border in Texas, has also deployed members of Utah's National Guard to the border in Texas to support the effort there, what's happening. So it is having an impact outside, certainly, of Texas. And we also see this becoming a thing more so in other border states. Greg, we're talking my new favorite word. My new favorite word is extraterritoriality.
Okay? I know, and you've used that before.
My
right.
second favorite word that used to be my favorite word was vexillology, which is the study of flags. But extraterritoriality is what we're talking about right now, Greg. Let's talk about abortion law in Texas and how that plays in.
Right. So Texas has now, in some of its counties, have tried to ban women from leaving the state for an abortion. Now, I don't know how you possibly enforce that, but that's what we're talking about. At its core, that's what we're talking about here. In at least four counties in Texas have provided that anyone who provides abortion assistance can be sued by private citizens in Texas. It was recently stopped by a federal judge, but that's the law that they had in Texas at the time, and they're still trying to override what the federal courts are trying to do. I don't know, extraterritorial jurisdiction. If a Utah resident wants to go to New York for something, let's say I hate to use the example. Let's say it's some sort of transgender surgery that maybe Utah law isn't all that favorable for because of the age or whatever. It's a horrible example, but it just comes to mind. What right does Utah have to stop some parent from taking their kid to New York and having the procedure done? I don't think there is such a law. I don't know how they can do that. And what they're saying is, well, people in Utah, or at least the Texas authority, are saying, well, if somebody does leave our state, our citizens can sue those providers, those doctors, those people that are performing these surgeries in the state of Texas for harm that they've allegedly caused to individuals, for citizens of Texas.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a stretch. That's a hard
interesting
one for me.
Greg, can you talk about reciprocity and what that is and how that ties into this conversation about states projecting power beyond borders?
Yeah, so that does happen a lot, and it happens in my world. I'll give you a real simple example. Drunk driving.
Okay.
You have a license. You're driving in Utah, but you happen to have an Oregon license. Maybe that's not the best state. You get a DUI in Utah. Utah says, we're taking your driving privilege away. They're going to ship that information to Oregon, too, and say, you should take their license away in Oregon for something they did in Utah. And there is reciprocity. There is it's called an interstate compact on driver's license. That's just an example that comes to mind with your question, where they say, okay, we're going to honor that as well. And we're going to say, and I don't even know if Oregon's part of the interstate compact. I was just using that as an example.
Sure,
but most states are, you got a DUI in Utah. We're not going to let you drive in Oregon either. Lawyers have the same problem. If you're barred in two states, let's say Utah and California, and you get disbarred in Utah, they're going to send that to California. And guess what? California is going to disbar you as well.
Got it. So we're talking about states upholding one another's laws, even if those laws are different.
Right.
I believe, for example, that if you have a permit to carry a gun in Texas, a concealed carry permit in Texas, you can do so in other states like Louisiana. Certain specific issues or laws, you know, there's agreements for reciprocity on different things. It gets super messy and complicated. I understand, Greg, that California has something about fogua. Is that how you pronounce it? We're talking essentially something that California doesn't like because it's made from livers of ducks and geese, right. And that's what they care about.
Let me tell you another example, just because I do criminal work that hits close to home. Utah drives to Colorado, buys recreational marijuana, not legal in Utah, legal in Colorado.
I've never heard of anyone doing that.
They come back to Utah, they get stopped. The officer says, what's up with that? I bought it legally in Colorado. There is no reciprocity in that regard.
Okay.
You can buy it legally in Colorado and you can use it legally in Colorado, but you got to stop at the border. You can't bring it back to Utah.
Yeah.
So people will tell me all the time, and it used to happen with alcohol all the time.
I've heard that also applies to very cool fireworks that one may be able to purchase in Nevada or Wyoming, Greg. I've heard about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny, the fireworks and alcohol venues just over the border in Wyoming and Nevada, not because they're legal in Utah, but because they're so easy for Utahns to get. So reciprocity only applies in certain things, certain areas, but in those arenas, boy, you got to keep it at the border. And because it's legal in one state doesn't mean it's legal in your state.
Yeah. Okay. So perhaps taking a step back here, a broader view nationally with national politics, the two-party system, particularly in Congress, is essentially total dysfunction. Mm-hmm. We're at a stalemate when it comes to the most important issues facing our country. Immigration comes to my mind first and foremost. And Congress has failed to do anything meaningful on immigration. Regardless of what you support policy-wise, Congress hasn't acted for decades. And there is no future, no hope in sight, really, of them acting. And I know we have like 30 seconds left, Greg, but in your opinion, does this push us closer to actually accomplishing policy change? Or are we setting ourselves up for just more political confrontation in Congress that results in the political status quo?
I don't know if this is the answer that you're expecting, but after the Dobbs decision, the United States Supreme Court has given a lot more authority to the states to make decisions about things. And I'm talking about flipping over Roe versus Wade and say, you know what, states, these are your issues. These are your decisions. This is what you're going to do. We're going to see more and more as the court drifts more and more to the right, states' rights as opposed to federal rights. You watch. It's happening now. And a lot of our Supreme Court justices have said, you know what, this is what we've been waiting for a long time.
Yeah. Interesting.
When we come back after the break, what would you like to be remembered for?
Arrested for importing marijuana as a Utah, Greg.
Okay. We'll talk about that after the break.
KSL at night.
Welcome back to KSL at night. This is Taylor Morgan alongside Greg Skordas, KSL legal analyst Greg Skordas. Greg, what would you like most to be remembered for?
You know, I thought about that because this segment was coming up, and without looking or sort of giving away the answers that a lot of people gave, I wouldn't have given those same answers. And I'll tell you, it's probably part of my Greek upbringing. And I'll just tell you, I'll give you an example in just a second. And also my former father-in-law, he passed away. The greatest compliment that they can pay someone, those two groups that I just mentioned, is he or she was a really hard worker.
Yeah.
You know, and I think when I heard this topic, I thought, you know, I would hope that maybe that's something I would be remembered for, somebody that worked really hard. On the other hand, that's been my downfall because you don't spend as much time with your family. You don't spend as much time with your children.
Yeah.
You don't spend as much time enjoying yourself. So maybe that's not something to be, to aspire for.
Yeah.
But just in terms of some of the communities and groups that I've been with, that's the greatest compliment you can have is that so-and-so was a hard worker.
Work ethic.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I wonder if that's a generational thing because I was very much raised with work ethic, being a hard worker. The reputation of being a hard worker was really very important, if not the most important thing, key to your reputation. I think maybe that's something that boomers, not calling you out, Greg,
but
perhaps the older generation, and for very good reason, had that work ethic and strove to instill that work ethic in their children.
Yeah.
So that's, I think it's really interesting. Greg, you work hard. You are America's most prominent successful defense attorney by day. You're also a ski patroller on the weekends at Powder Mountain.
Ski patrol and KSL.
And KSL, and you're super fit and svelte, and you're kind of a renaissance man. So you do work hard, right?
Yes.
On the other hand, there's me.
No, you're always working.
And
every time I see you, you're working it.
Listen, I do like to think I work hard. I like to play hard. I don't know how I would answer this question, Greg. I think that if I had to choose something that would be my number one, what I would want to be remembered for, I would want people to remember me as being maybe fun and honest.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have to think about that more.
So let's talk about a study that just came out. And by the way, this study was conducted by Sharpie and Papermate.
Wait.
They commissioned a study. I don't know why Sharpie and Papermate are doing a study, but they
did. Well, if you're going to write about, you know, something you want to remember, you're going to choose Sharpie and not pencil, maybe.
2,000 Americans were queried, and the question was, what would you most like to be remembered for? And the number one answer is, guess what? Creativity.
What? Was this strictly a poll of millennials, Greg?
Well, they all had Sharpies and paper mates. And so somebody said, what do you want to be remembered for? And they're drawing little cartoons with their Sharpie. And I want to be remembered for creativity.
Interesting.
1 in 3 out of the 2,000 people questioned said they want to be remembered for their creativity. That came in ahead of intelligence, which was 20%. So 30% creativity, 20% intelligence, 14% wanted to be remembered for their wealth. That's kind of odd. And 10% humanitarian work.
Humanitarian work.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So work, but humanitarian, the kind of work that you did.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really interesting study that they have that kind of breakdown. Creativity, maybe like you say, maybe that's a generational thing. Maybe that was part of the group. It doesn't say who the Sharpie people were interviewing, but yeah.
Well, it does say, according to the study here, that 65% of those in this study, we're talking American consumers. It doesn't necessarily say voters, right? We're just talking 65% of American adults define creativity as, quote, expressing yourself or, quote, coming up with new ideas. I think that's really interesting.
So you want to be known for expressing yourself. Oh, he really expressed himself. Or he was always coming up, or she was always coming up with new ideas. I guess I could understand that. I'm not going to be remembered for either of those things.
Yeah. According to a study that was published, so let's be clear, this isn't just according to this poll of Americans conducted by Sharpie and Papermate. They didn't do the poll, right? They hired a legitimate, reputable polling firm to do the poll for them.
Right, yeah.
I do think, Greg, we have to assume that perhaps in the universe of the respondents, it might lean a little more toward the artistic, artsy, creative side.
That's what it seems like.
Given that Sharpie and Papermate were behind it. So we're maybe talking a higher proportion of artists or creative folks involved in this. But again, getting back, this isn't just this study. According to a study published in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health in 2021, the study was titled Being Creative Makes You Happier. This study was all about the positive effects of creativity on well-being. I think that's really interesting. When you think about creativity, Greg, would you call yourself a creative person?
You know, a minute ago I said I'm not, but I think I am. I think you have to be in my field and yours.
Yeah.
Because people come to you with a problem and you have to come up with a solution. And that requires creativity. I mean, as an attorney, somebody's in trouble and they need some help or they're trying to figure something out, you've got to be creative. You've got to come off the wall.
Oh,
in your business, people come to you all the time with plans, with ideas, with whether it's legislation, whether it's some political agenda that they have. And you can't just, because you and I talk about this a lot. Well, even earlier today, we talked about, just for example, are billboards a good way to express your political campaign and make yourself known? But you said, no, there are other things you can do. You've got to be creative. You've got to be able to do things. I think that's what makes you successful.
Interesting.
I mean, I think that creativity and expressing yourself and getting people to express themselves is something that you teach. That's what people come to you for.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I definitely would like to be more creative. I don't necessarily see myself, or I wouldn't define myself as a creative person, but I do try to think about things differently and see things in a different way and try to be innovative in that sense. But I think
creativity is coming up with new ideas,
yeah,
maybe you are.
Yeah, definitely.
Or well, expressing yourself.
Even adapting, existing things or strategies or outlooks or this or that. I definitely think that in my own experience, in my own life, I have found a lot of happiness and well-being when I am being creative, maybe lowercase creative in my own way. I'm not an artist, Greg. I cannot draw. I don't even try to do anything artistic whatsoever because it just will not work. But in terms of, my work or my hobbies, things I like to do outdoors or whatnot, I'm always trying to maybe put my own spin on them. And maybe that counts, at least for me.
And a study found that Americans use writing 14% to alleviate stress, painting 12% to alleviate stress, and my favorite, doodling 10% as a way to alleviate stress.
Doodling.
Yeah, doodling. I mean, what don't we just draw?
Does that have to be with...
I don't know that I do it to alleviate stress. You just do it to alleviate...
Does that have to be with a Sharpie and or a pen and paper? Or can we doodle on our devices?
Yeah, I mean,
what counts there?
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, again, one last study to round this out, and then we're almost out of time, Greg. Forbes. Okay, we're talking Forbes. So another credible study reported that being creative, even in minimal personal ways, creative pursuits can increase happiness, reduce dementia, improve mental health, boost the immune system, and make you smarter.
There you go.
Okay. Well, so everyone, be creative. Get creative. If you ever feel like you want to go back and dive into the archives of KSL at Night episodes, Greg, there's a lot of fun stuff in there. You can get creative with that, perhaps.
There you go.
Those are available on kslpodcast.com. That's certainly a great, wonderful new resource to share with our listeners. Wonderful show tonight, Greg. Had a lot of fun here with you in studio. Looking forward again to more KSL at Night tomorrow. Thanks for listening.